All those iPods and other electronic devices have given rise to a sub-industry of neighborhood enterprises. It's kind of like the days long ago when bottles of milk were delivered to your door, or a repairman would come. These days, repair people will pull up in their vans and in minutes fix your MP3 player or your iPhone or get you a new screen for the laptop. NPR's Margo Adler reports.
Dimitri Leontaris sometimes calls himself the iPod doctor, and his license plate says exactly that. But the first thing you notice is how many people come up to his van and ask him for a business card.
Just give us a call and we can set up an appointment.
Okay, thanks a lot. Do you work with Macintosh?
Leontaris repairs cell phones, laptops, and digital music players, and he says his business got started by chance.
I fell in love with the iPod when I saw one. I didn't really have money to buy one, so I bought a broken one thinking I'd get it fixed by Apple for a decent price.
But he found out Apple's repair prices were too steep, so he bought another broken iPod for the parts, took them both apart, and fixed one of them before he knew it.
I just kept running into people with broken iPods that wanted them fixed.
Whether your BlackBerry has a cracked screen or you threw your Zune into the laundry, Leontaris generally has a fix. He sees about 10 to 15 clients a day and has two technicians working for him. He picks up his phone, which rests on his knee.
Hi, Eddie. How are you? I'm here. I'm at 86th and 3rd, right by the Banana Republic. It's across the street from the Papaya King. Can't miss me.
So you have all your tools with you?
Yep. I keep them either in the cup holder here or in my bag, but everything's pretty portable.
Leontaris sits behind the wheel in his black van. His seatbelt is buckled. He has a tiny silver toolkit the size of a lunchbox that sits on his lap and also acts as a work table. Eddie Gonzalez and his son bring two iPods. One needs a new battery, which has to be soldered in the shop. The click wheel is broken on the other one.
Yep. There's a fairly simple explanation for this. There's a rubber piece behind the button that slipped down out of place. We're going to put it back into place now.
It costs Gonzalez $49. Gonzalez found Leontaris on the internet, of course, saw a couple of nice reviews.
They're all true, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how you heard about him.
That's correct.
Leontaris says his business goes in cycles. Students want their laptops fixed before school reopens, winter break and spring break are hot times. But the worst time is just before Christmas because people are waiting to see what they'll get.
I've actually had people tell me on the phone, well, let me see if I get a new one for Christmas and I'll call you back next week.
But cyclical or not, he says business has doubled since the downturn in the economy. Dimitri Leontaris' next client is 23-year-old Shanti King, who has an iPhone with a screen that's totally cracked. She has come with her computer-savvy boyfriend.
How did it happen?
Well, I smashed it somehow with all the obstacles and things in my bag.
She sat on it. She sat on her bag with the phone was in there.
Leontaris takes out the tiny screws with a miniature screwdriver, opens it up, puts on a new LCD screen. The whole operation takes place in the car, and it only takes about 7 minutes. Price, $99 for parts and service. He says people like having stuff fixed. They don't like to waste things. I'm giving them back their music, he says, their videos, and sometimes even their sanity. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. From smartphone to smartphone number, we're going to hear about Google Voice, plus Microsoft's plan to beat Apple at its own game. Meet the Microsoft Store. Those tech stories and more in just a few minutes, but first, you've heard of wiring money, but what about wireless money? Imagine you get a call from your son. He needs money. His bank balance is zip. And now imagine pulling out your cell phone and, with the touch of a few buttons, sending him however much he needs, as easily as sending a text message. Well, that's the idea, as NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
Outside the U.S., millions of people already are using their cell phones to transfer money, pay bills, and even buy products at a store. The concept just hasn't caught on here in the U.S., but some big companies like MasterCard and Citibank want to change that. I signed up for a free mobile payment service through Amazon and set out on the streets of Denver to hand out some virtual dollar bills.
I'm Lisa Simkovitz, and I'm from Denver, Colorado.
Okay, so we're going to try to send you a dollar here. Okay.
I send a text message to Amazon with the instruction, wait for a phone call.
Oh.
Then after I authorize the $1 payment, Simkovitz receives a text message.
So what does it say?
You've got money. You received a dollar from Jeffrey A. Brady. Go to payment at Amazon.com.
Awesome. It worked.
How exciting.
Have you ever used something like that before?
No.
So can you imagine, like, any situation where you might use a service like that?
Maybe if you're, like, out of money somewhere and you need, like, to get wired money and not around a bank.
If Simkovic seems less than impressed, here's why. The process is pretty complicated. Now she has to go home, sign up for an Amazon account, and then deposit my dollar into her bank account before she can use it. It would have been a lot easier if I'd just given her a dollar. There are a few people who found a use for this service. OboPay is a mobile payment startup company that has a business relationship with MasterCard. Folks there referred me to Rob Berkson and his daughter Gabby. She's away at college in New York. He's in a D.C. suburb, and he's used OboPay to send her emergency money.
And the money was ready to access instantly.
That was the big key. So if something came up, you know, let's say she needed to buy a book or something, you know, and she needed $100. She could just call. I could just open up my OboPay account on the computer.
And within a few minutes, the money was in her account. A Boston company called Mercatus has been tracking and promoting the development of mobile payments in the U.S. Bob Hedges is the managing partner at the firm.
If you look at the research we did a year ago, 2 years ago, anyone over the age of 45 had never heard of it, wasn't interested in it, was almost viewed as a little bit kooky.
But he says that's starting to change, and he predicts that mobile payments are on the verge of experiencing the same kind of fast growth online banking enjoyed over the past decade. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
40 years ago today, three astronauts blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. They were beginning the historic Apollo 11 mission, the first manned voyage ever to reach the surface of the moon.
That's one small step for man.
Hundreds of millions of people watched on television as Neil Armstrong took that first step. But the pictures that people saw were dark and fuzzy. The astronauts actually sent back better images, higher quality footage that was recorded by engineers on Earth. But 3 years ago, NPR reported that those original tapes were missing. Our report helped to trigger an exhaustive search by NASA. And NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce recently got an exclusive sneak peek at the 1969 moonwalk like you have never seen it before.
Stan Labar is almost 84 years old. Decades ago, he led a team that designed and built a TV camera that is currently on the moon, right where the Apollo 11 astronauts left it. Labar says his camera actually captured better images of their moonwalk than people saw on TV.
It was better. We knew it was better.
But the lunar camera recorded in an odd format that was incompatible with the normal TV format. So when the footage was received on Earth, it had to be converted for broadcast. That conversion degraded the image. However, engineers on the ground did record the unconverted raw footage onto tapes. Labar and some colleagues recently decided to go back and look at those tapes.
The whole thing started with the idea that this is the one piece of television footage that's going to be played for the next 50 or 100 or 300 years. Those that follow us deserve better than what we had.
But the tapes were missing. For the last 3 years, a monumental search has been underway.
We had hundreds and hundreds of leads coming to us during this period. Every one of them was investigated.
Labar and other searchers spent hours and hours in a vast government storage facility known as the Washington National Records Center, something that sounds like the giant warehouse at the end of the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Stacked with racks of documents, tapes, all kinds of things from NASA and other agencies.
Dick Nafsker is a TV specialist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He became the unofficial leader of the search team. He says they also went to remote storage facilities, to private homes. They pored over logbooks and memos and all kinds of 40-year-old handwritten records.
We went through old file cabinets that would have little record cards and give you an idea of an shipment went in with the name Apollo on it, and did it have Apollo or tape, or did it have anything on there that could be a tape?
They returned again and again to that vast government warehouse, but then they discovered something disturbing. Over the years, NASA had removed massive numbers of magnetic tapes from the shelves. Between 1981 to 1983, NASA permanently withdrew over 40,000 boxes. Why? Labar says new satellites had gone up. The satellites were producing a lot of data that needed to be recorded.
These satellites were suddenly using tapes 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
And the agency was experiencing a critical shortage of magnetic tapes. So NASA started erasing old ones and reusing them. That's probably what happened to the original footage from the moon that the astronauts took with Labar's camera.
So I don't believe that the tapes exist today at all.
I mean, are you sad about that?
Yeah. Well, it was a hard thing to accept, but there was just an overwhelming amount of evidence that led us to believe that they just don't exist anymore. And you have to accept reality.
You may have to accept reality, but that doesn't mean you have to give in to it. Nafsker says, look, they started this search with one goal.
Our goal was to provide to the world the best possible video of a historic event we could for the future.
Since the raw footage was gone, the team decided to try to find the best of what was preserved in the converted broadcast format. Nafsker says they looked through tapes in Australia, tapes in the CBS News archive, stuff no one had looked at in decades.
We found immediately that just because it was broadcast didn't mean it was similar quality. The quality of broadcast TV in existence of 1969 broadcast TV was varied extremely between sources.
Using all of these sources, they pieced together the best possible version of the moonwalk. And then, to make it even better, they turned to the magic of Hollywood.
We had been in contact at that point with a company called Lowry Digital in California.
They contacted me at Lowry Digital here in Burbank with the objective of, can this material be restored?
John Lowry has a lot of experience doing high-quality digital restorations of old films.
Such as old Bambi, Cinderella, Lady and the Tramp, 20 James Bond movies.
And the Star Wars films, just to name a few. Early in his career, Lowry had actually worked on footage from later Apollo missions. So he was excited to have the chance to work on the first moonwalk. Over 100 computers processed the images, carefully removing things like random noise and camera shake, without destroying the image's historical legitimacy.
We've got to be very, very mindful of history. If you want to go to the extreme, you could take these images and completely recreate them. You could create a three-dimensional model of the lunar lander, and you could make it look beautiful. But I don't think that's the point. I think the point is that Apollo 11 was a very, very special historical event.
Last week at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Dick Nafsker sat down at a computer loaded with the restored video, which he just received from California the day before. He called up a side-by-side comparison of the old and new. On the left side of his monitor was the dark, murky footage of Neil Armstrong coming down the ladder of his LEM spacecraft, about to make his first step.
As you can see on the left, there's nothing but a dark image and possibly a foot. If I told you it was a foot, you'd probably say, okay, it must be a foot.
On the right hand of his screen was the new version.
You can see the structure of the LEM. You can see his full outline of his body, his helmet, a reflection in his helmet. It's still not pristine, it's not clean in detail, but it's now an astronaut, and it's something no one saw before. This is the first step on the moon.
The restoration won't be complete until the fall, but NASA is releasing some short clips today to mark the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11 blasting off of Earth towards its moment in history. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Anytime you're in front of a computer today, you can see the restored video of the moonwalk by going to NPR.org.
Well, joining us now, once again, is Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. Welcome once again, Omar.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And as we heard Jeff Brady say there, that kind of mobile banking he was describing is already used elsewhere in the world. Why are other countries ahead of the U.S. in that technology?
Right. If you think about some countries like, say, China or India, they really don't use computers the way we do as much. I mean, a lot more is relied on with cell phones. So if you look at our future, where we're using mobile phones more and maybe computers less, you see that change kind of coming over here as well. There's a company that I've spoken to that specializes in financial services for developing countries. They're doing some really fascinating stuff in Latin America and Russia, India. I'm thinking, you know, we're going to see some real big global changes just from having basic financial services in developing areas.
Huh. Well, now on to some other tech stories in the news. Just when I thought that the octopus, that is Google, could not grow any more tentacles, here comes something called Google Voice that's being tested. What does Google Voice do?
Well, it started as a service aptly named Grand Central to kind of wrangle and control all of the different telephone numbers you might have. Say you have a cell phone, an office number, a home number. Google wants to give you one new phone number that will control all of these. You'll be able to route calls wherever you want. You'll be able to have all of your phones ring at one time if somebody calls you and you need to have them get a hold of you. And it also has some features that you maybe wouldn't expect from a phone service, things like being able to transcribe your voicemail or being able to record a call in the middle of it and have it stored online.
And this service would cost me how much?
It would actually be free, as we've come to expect from most of Google services. The catch is that it's not available to everyone yet. Right now, it's invite only, but we will probably be seeing this spread to everybody else very soon.
Let's move on to another tech giant, Microsoft, and its ongoing war with Apple. What is the latest salvo from Microsoft?
Well, if you've seen Microsoft's Laptop Hunter commercials, they're really taking Apple to task on pricing, especially of laptops. And now Microsoft says that it plans to open retail stores next to Apple stores. So they're taking the competition right to the mall. Apple stores are really more than about pricing. They really are about creating a strong customer experience. When you walk into an Apple store, there's definitely a different vibe there than you might get from other electronic stores. And Microsoft is not really known for their TLC when it comes to customer support. So it's going to be a really big challenge for them. I mean, if you ask Sony with their Sony style stores, how they've done against Apple, not so well. They really haven't created that same experience as Apple. So it makes me wonder, just based on my experiences with Windows, whether you know, if you go into a Microsoft store, you're going to get asked by a security guard every time you want to touch something, whether you really want to be touching that.
Well, we have time for one more tech story, and I know that you're eager to relate one from what I think of as the high-tech meets low-culture department. Tell us about the online existence of Keyboard Cat.
Right. Keyboard Cat is a short music video from the 80s featuring a catchy little tune of a cat playing on a keyboard, which we can listen to.
Very, very high-quality synthesizer there.
Now, if you can imagine a cat on the keyboard playing those keys, the paws are being moved around by the owner. Now, what's significant about this is that this original video that was posted on YouTube became a viral hit when people started mixing it with other videos. Keyboard Cat has interrupted everyone from Charlie Chaplin to Barack Obama. And recently, there was a video of Keyboard Cat playing along with Hall & Oates on the song You Make My Dreams Come True. And that video ran into trouble on YouTube when Warner Music Group decided they didn't want that audio appearing because of copyright concerns.
So they sued Keyboard Kitty?
They didn't sue, but they stripped the audio out of it. So now if you go to YouTube and look for a Keyboard Cat and Hall & Oates, you will see the video, but you will hear no sound. But one bit of trivia is that the original cat named Fatso actually passed away in 2000, but Keyboard Cat's spirit lives on forever in online videos, we hope.
It's Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Robert. And we will indeed be putting Keyboard Cat on the AllTech blog at npr.org/alltech.
Thank you for that.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now, in the world of social media, there've got to be some rules, right? Well, how about these?
If you can't buy it online, feel free to BitTorrent. Don't hesitate to haggle on Craigslist. And whatever you do, don't Google stalk before a first date.
That's Nancy Miller. She's an editor at Wired Magazine, where the upcoming cover story is titled How to Behave, New Rules for Highly Evolved Humans, a Scientific Approach to 21st Century Predicaments. And Nancy Miller joins me from member station KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
We'll get to some more of the rules in a minute, but first, why did you all feel the need to write them in the first place?
You'd think at Wired we would naturally know how to do all this stuff.
But of course.
And it seemed like we were all a little bit confused about this new world, specifically with social media and the etiquette of the new world around us. And what we found was, you know, there was a lot of subjective opinion on how to behave, but we didn't have really one solid approach. So we sort of decided that the best way to go about this was the Wired way, which is try and find a scientific approach, a social science, to explain how and why we behave like we do and what makes sense in this new era of technology.
And you guys actually used real live social scientists to compile this list, right?
We did, because what we noticed with other etiquette books that we were checking out to inspire us was that a lot of it was just sort of either opinion or sort of this prim intuition about how to behave. And what we felt like we needed was, you know, some real data, and it seemed to make sense that we would go to behaviorists, social psychologists, and anthropologists for ideas on how humans behave.
Let's go through some of the rules for a moment. There's one which is don't Google stalk before a first date, which means don't sort of search out the person you're about to date on Google. This is almost de rigueur these days. What's wrong with checking up on somebody you're going to go out on a date with?
You know, I love this one because I think this one is a surprise. It's counterintuitive. You would think the more you know, the better you're going to be walking in. But it turns out that, according to the social psychologist we interviewed, is that a key part of what bonds people together is mutual self-disclosure. So it's okay for you to say, you know, do the basics, find out if the person has maybe a criminal past. But to look any further past that, you're going in with more information than you probably need, and it's going to sort of make an imbalance between you and that person.
Well, what if you're straightforward with them and they tell you something on the date and you say, oh, yeah, I knew that. I read about you on Google.
See, no, I think that's the dilemma. So the dilemma is if you say, oh, yeah, I knew you did that. I saw that on Google. Then you look creepy. and then if you don't, and you did Google them and then you lie and they're telling you things about themselves that you already know, then you sort of look insincere.
Or then you are creepy.
You are creepy. And the key point of when you're going, especially like with a date on someone, you don't want to be creepy. So less is more on this one.
All right. There's another one. It says, don't blog or tweet about anything with more than 500,000 hits. That means I shouldn't tweet about chocolate rain or Ooling the pancake rabbit.
Yeah, this is one of those things where, you know, there's a certain moment in time, and someone described it to us as the velocity of adoption. So there's a certain moment where there's a build of a trend, let's say the Justin Timberlake video or something that has about a 3-day to week-long window. I mean, it depends on how much time. But the velocity of adoption means that there's a certain moment where it's okay to forward, but we tracked that at 500,000 views or 500,000 hits, it's done.
Nancy, what's your favorite rule?
I think that the one I really liked was friend your boss, but not your boss's boss, and follow them both on Twitter. And what I liked about this one is that this is sort of, you know, we're following cues from the primates here. And this sort of sense of hierarchy within the orangutan and primate world. Your immediate boss is your sort of power protector. But the boss's boss, that's almost too high up for you. So there's a certain moment where that might actually be kind of threatening, or at least threatening to the giant ape that is your boss, or your boss's boss. So you can follow them, but don't expect to, like, friend them. That's just two levels too high up in the hierarchy.
Nancy Miller is an editor for Wired magazine. The August cover story is called How to Behave, New Rules for Highly Evolved Humans, and it hits newsstands on Tuesday. We also have a link at npr.org to all of the rules, which also include never broadcast your relationship status and never BCC, that's blind carbon copy, anyone. Nancy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I won't tweet about it, but you've got to check out Ooling the Pancake Rabbit.
You caught me. I'm happy to check that out. Thanks for looping me in.
And just a few miles from Facebook's headquarters, another Silicon Valley startup is hoping to become the next big thing. It's called Aardvark, and it uses your profile from services like Facebook and your online friends to help you get advice on specific questions. Questions you might not get a good answer from by Googling, for example. New York Times tech columnist David Pogue took Aardvark for a spin.
It takes advantage of the modern social networking era to give you something that nobody's quite done before, which is harness the power of the internet to give you answers quickly from the one person who might know best.
Most people now have a few hundred friends on a social network such as Facebook.
That's Damon Horowitz, one of the founders and chief technology officer for Aardvark.
If each of those friends has a few hundred friends, that's tens of thousands of people in your extended social network. It's too large of a number for you to keep up with all of the things that your friends know and all the things that their friends know. So that's where Aardvark comes in. It's applying technology to index all of that information and deliver the right person.
So we decided to try Aardvark out ourselves to see if it's all that it's cracked up to be. Okay, so I'm now typing, what's a good present for my nephew who's turning 13? He likes gadgets, so maybe something electronic, but not an iPod. And I'm going to hit send. And hopefully, Aardvark will find someone in my online network who might know and then send me the answer back.
Most questions are answered in under 5 minutes.
Once more, Aardvark founder Damon Horowitz.
You find yourself suddenly talking with somebody who was a friend of a friend, and it is a magical experience when it happens.
But what do these people get out of answering those questions? Here's David Pogue of the New York Times again.
There is an ego boost at knowing the answer and feeling good that you just helped out somebody out there. These are total strangers who are sitting by their instant messaging programs waiting for questions from total strangers that they can answer for free. That always surprises me, but I'm happy for it.
Okay, let's check to see whether we got an answer to our question. I was looking for a good gift for my 13-year-old nephew who likes gadgets, but not an iPod. I see that Johan from Ashley, Ohio, has answered, and he writes, have you considered an iPhone 3GS? Not exactly the answer I was hoping for, but I guess the service is only as good as your network. Aardvark's been up for about a month, and so far it's focused pretty much on Facebook. But co-founder Damon Horowitz says soon it will expand to work with other sites as well. And you can try it out at vark.com.